Hello, welcome to a Transmedia podcast. Today we are sharing with you Mandy Rose's presentation for Conductor Conference 2015. She talks about the changes that documentary projects have faced with the new digital technologies and the changes in technology and the new ways of collaboration and co-creation.
I am one of the three co-directors of the IDOX project with Sandra Gaudenzi, who's here, and Judith Aston. IDOX is a research group at the University of the West of England. We have a website, we have a Facebook community, and we run a biannual symposium. Call for participation is out now. Please check out the site if you're interested and get in touch with us with a proposal. So the history of documentary. Documentaries have been a fluid form, and the history of documentary has been a story of adaptation and change as producers have taken advantage of different generations of technologies and the affordances of those technologies, the things that they allow. We can think about the moment when the voice came to cinema in the 30s and the way that offered documentary a kind of intimacy, a kind of witness to events through the human voice. Or the moment around 1960 when sync sound technology completely changed documentary from something which was kind of heavy on a tripod, very static, very staged, to something which was kind of fluid, on the move. The whole idea of kind of fly on the wall, of being able to follow events as they unfold. And certain ideas came at that time around truth and reality, the notion that you could capture truth as if unmediated, a problematic notion. So digital has amplified that process of change ushering in transformation on multiple fronts, you know, in tools, in form, in platforms, in economic models, and in the people who are getting involved in documentary. Journalism now very involved, NGOs are very involved, completely changing. And perhaps most significant is the change for documentary in its role for critiquing our social world. Because there's a transformation in the relationship with the audience. The people that documentary speaks about can now be part of that project. The people formerly known as the audience, as Jay Rosen said, can now be users, interactors, and content creators. So just think about the cheap, accessible tools for media making, the change that's happened in 20 years. We've all got a video recording device in our pockets. I think probably everyone in this room. We could all, in 5 minutes, potentially publish some video we'd shot now to YouTube or to another platform. That's really transformational for documentary. At the same time, you've got the web, this open platform for content sharing and distribution. And you've got the connectivity of online, what Clay Shirky called the ridiculously easy group formation that's now supported by social media. So any one of these developments would have been profound for documentary. Together, they represent a really powerful shift, allowing individuals and communities to play a part in the way documentary reflects and critiques our world as participant observers out there in their communities or as expert witnesses on issues that affect their own lives. So we can already see many examples of work, documentary work, which takes advantage of these affordances. A quick whip through. Take a look at Man with a Movie Camera, the global remake, started in 2006, still live now. The invitation from Perry Bard, the artist, is for you to remake one shot from Vertov's 1929 film. People are still contributing those shots. This piece is a generative piece, changing every day and still ongoing. That's the interface through which you find out about contributing. 18 Days in Egypt. This piece followed the revolution of early 2011 and invited people who had tweeted or posted on Facebook at the time to look back at those tweets and put more context around them. Think about where they happened, what they meant, who was there, to curate their own story by building on that original content. Palestine Remix. Oh no, sorry, Génération Quoi. A project from Arte France, I think, or France TV. Yeah, okay. Which invited people of the kind of the 18 to 25 generation to contribute to a survey about their own lives. It invited people to become part of a collective account of that generation's experience. Or Palestine Remix, a current project from Al Jazeera, which invites people to remix stories already shot about Palestine place and issue, and in a sense provide an alternative history through their recutting, to annotate archive material in the context of how contested that history is. So this participation within documentary media that's allowed by a new generation of tools brings a new dimension to the documentary project, which the scholar Bill Nichols thinks of as it's about telling stories about our shared world, reflecting our collective experience and interrogating that experience. So it brings a new dimension to that central project of documentary. So while there are a number of distinctive currents in what we're seeing now, this idea of participation within documentary is not new. We can think of 20th century documentary as a professional project to a large extent because the gear you needed to make a documentary was heavy, was expensive, was rare, and costly. There were film formats for amateurs. You know, we've heard of the home movies of the 20th century, Super 8, 8mm. But in documentary, you had this exclusive cadre of people who interpreted the world on our behalf. And shaped the footage that they shot into real-life stories that circulated in the public sphere. But documentary, or at least social documentary, is, of course, a practice that involves people, the people behind the camera and the people in front of it. It's always been subject to negotiation and dialogue between the people on either side. So it's unsurprising in a way that the germs of today's participation lie in some of the very earliest documentary experiences. 1935, housing problems, a film being made in London's East End, on which Ruby Grierson, sister of John Grierson, who's commonly thought of as the father of documentary, she was working as a production assistant. And on that film, in an incident that Grierson, she died unfortunately very young, but an incident that John Grierson related in his biography, she invited the slum dwellers who were, you know, describe their lives directly to camera. You can see that direct look. Metaphorically handing over the recording equipment, she urged them to take the opportunity to state their case to those in power. "The camera is yours," she said. "The microphone is yours. Now tell the bastards exactly what it's like to live in the slums." And this is a kind of legendary story, partly because I think there's a gender issue, the kind of like, oh my God, you know, the woman production assistant stepping out of line, but also because it was so untypical of the 20th century arrangement. Although, you know, back in 22, when Robert Flaherty had been making Nanook of the North, one of the founding pieces of documentary, he went to great lengths so that the rushes could be processed on location. "It has always been most important to me," he said, "to see the rushes. But another reason for developing the film in the North was to project it to the Eskimos so that they would accept and understand what I was doing and work together with me as partners." So setting a pattern that was to become the norm, that partnership ended when the location shooting ended. In the cutting room, the film was Flaherty's to make, Flaherty's to decide on. "This is the world as I see it," is how you can think of that kind of 20th century documentary proposition. The documentary maker taking the footage as building blocks to build a story or to make an argument. And in that kind of model, there was little space for those Inuit he'd been working with to have a say in how the overall turned out. But the idea of the documentary subject's rights had also surfaced a long time ago. That idea of the auteur being in control was contested through the 20th century. We see things like the Workers' Newsreel project in 1930s America, where there was an attempt to put filmmaking into the hands of the working class at a moment when they were really up against the depression and unemployment. In Paris in May 68, in a kind of moment of turmoil, of critique of capitalism and consumerism, film was seen as a central arena of the struggle. And film equipment was given to the Renault workers, among others, and who made a film about their situation. And round about the same time, across the Atlantic, a programme was developed at the National Film Board of Canada called Challenge for Change, which attempted to use media to support development and support local community. So, and within the Challenge for Change programme in 1968, in a first of this kind, the National Film Board gave cameras and training to Native Americans who were protesting a bridge being built in the middle of their land. So they had to pay tolls just to get kind of moved to another space within their own area. So this You Are an Indian Land inspired people around the world over time, and was the kind of founding work in the development of access media and community media, which then followed in the North America, the UK, and elsewhere. So the work we're seeing today builds, at times consciously, on these traditions. In 2006, Katerina Cizek, a Canadian documentarist, was invited by the National Film Board of Canada to reinvent that Challenge for Change model in the context of digital. She joined the National Film Board and spent a couple of years embedded at a hospital in Toronto as a filmmaker in residence, working through the kind of idea of what it would mean to use digital affordances in this context, in the context of community. And then in 2009, she started a project called High Rise, which, put your hands up if you come across the High Rise project. Good, okay, cool. So she started this project, which became a major project, a multi-year project to examine the unexamined sphere of life in high-rises on the edge of our cities. These high-rise buildings that tend to cluster kind of not right in the centre but on the peripheries of our cities are a primary mode of living in the world today. And they're also a place where people who are immigrants and people who are poorer often live. And that whole area had been under-examined. And Katerina says that got into a conversation with academics who were beginning to think about a new realm of inquiry, which they were calling global suburbanisms, life in these blocks. And she began to make a project working with them and also working with Toronto, with town planners, with architects, and crucially with a group of high-rise residents who, in a sense, have been her participant informers in the high-rise project. So high-rise, as Cizek explains, is not about these buildings and the people who live there, but it's designed with and made with that group, as well as with these professionals who have a deep interest in the issues of life in those blocks. So there have been lots of iterations of High Rise, and I would urge you to take a look at it. I'm so sorry I'm not showing you clips from some of these projects, but you must check them all out if you haven't seen them already. So Cizek describes co-creation like this. For me, co-creation is a broad term that implies a collaboration with the intent to make quality media with others instead of just about them. Participatory media is just one form of co-creation when people have the technology in their hands to make media, a methodology that's appropriate for some contexts and not others. So this is kind of interesting. Cizek is very interesting about this, partly because she sees her role as media maker as bringing her expertise. Her determination in these projects is to produce something as impactful and high quality as possible, but she sees that as best done in a dialogue where various people bring their expertise to the table, and she listens and she does everything she can with her professional training. So this has resulted in a number of projects. This one, for instance, One Millionth Tower, is a project which observes the process that happens when architects and high-rise dwellers in Toronto imagine how their blocks might be transformed, might be reworked, redeveloped. And these are the kind of sketches that came out of that process. So this is a documentary which observes that process. And many of, you know, many of the things that they imagined in this process have come to pass. A short history of the high rise, another type of co-creation in high rise, which came about when Sizek talked to the New York Times and discovered they'd got this extraordinary archive, untapped to a large extent, of the history of the high rise. And she worked with them and through them put out a call to a broader public to contribute images of their experience. So one more quote, because I think this one's important too, and I think it's implicit in Sizek's work. Co-creative media provides a tool for describing the ways in which participatory media are facilitated by people and organisations, not just technology. And I think, and it goes on to sort of speak about this idea of the magic of technology. I think often when people think about participation, there's a notion that a call to action on a website or a kind of something said on Twitter is going to make something happen. Well, maybe sometimes it does make something happen, but I think you have to think about who you're engaging with on particular platforms. Who's going to feel able to contribute on those platforms? Who's going to have the skills, the technology, and the inclination to contribute around those platforms? So the idea of co-creation, the idea of a deliberate work of co-making, allows you to engage with audiences, publics, who wouldn't come to you through this magical idea of technology. So here's a project which does just that, the Holo Project, created by Elaine McMillian and her team in West Virginia, in a county adjacent to the county where Elaine grew up, a county which, like much of rural America, is suffering depopulation, and economic marginalisation and disenfranchisement. And Elaine and her team went down to West Virginia to tell a story through that community, which is a common story of post-industrial America. And they set about that piece of work by facilitating local workshops, asset mapping, creating an online community newspaper, a Facebook space. They created that work in a deep dialogue with the people of McDowell County, West Virginia, who responded to the project because the issue of representation is they saw as a critical issue. The way that they were only ever described in the media as a problem place, a place with drug addiction, a place with prostitution. And people were kind of fed up with this kind of consistent negative image that was coming back to them. And here are some of the comments that people there made about the project, which I think are really interesting, the kind of positive response to Elaine coming. It's almost like she's seen as a kind of saviour. These were some among many comments I saw rather like this. But in the context where there's a kind of rhetoric of universal participation, these quotes underline how, without the intervention of someone like Elaine, people wouldn't be getting involved. It takes that kind of engagement for people in a community like that to feel they can be involved. A situation which Henry Jenkins has described as the participation gap. It's not the digital divide, which is about whether people have access to the tools, whether the technologies. It's the divide between those who feel they can take part and those who feel excluded or don't feel that they're entitled to a public voice. So at the same time, when we think about co-creation, when we think about participation, I think it's important that we're not naive about the context of networked culture, a context that we've been learning more and more about the dark side of the last few years. And bear in mind that it's the same context that allows participation and interactivity is the environment in which we now see corporate control of social media. The openness that supports co-creation also allows tracking, targeted advertising, data mining, and forms of exploitative crowdsourcing. So I think we need to kind of take care, if we're thinking about these space, of those other issues. So if we're thinking about designing co-creation, that's a challenging project. How do we give meaningful form to a story, engaging participants? How do we go beyond a crowdsourcing logic? How do we share editorial authority? And how do we work in an effective and an ethical way? So I'm going to finish with two examples, in neither of which the participants are content creators, but I think they're very much co-creators of the projects. So this is a still from a project called the Kipu Project, which is by Shaka Films, and it's still at an early stage of its development. The issue, as this explains, has to do with the enforced sterilization of many, many indigenous Peruvian people within a government program in the late 90s. An issue which, you know, there would be a documentary model which is, having discovered this story, the documentary makers dash off, you know, shoot about it and make a film and you know, turn that film over to the public, as it were. You know, giving the primacy to the public good and the right to know. But what Shaka Films did was they asked themselves, what would it mean to make this story with the community, with the people affected by the story? And Shaka includes one Peruvian filmmaker and a couple of other South American filmmakers. So instead, they took a participatory design approach in the first stages of the project. They worked with community groups. They workshopped with women and men involved. And at the same time, keeping in mind the wider political context of Peru and the struggle for legal address to the problem that had been going on around, there had been a number of court cases already. The message they got in those workshops was that those involved wanted to tell their stories, wanted to bear witness, wanted to become better at telling their stories so that when they went to court, they'd be effective, and wanted to hear each other's stories too. So what Shaka Films did was they designed a lo-fi solution, an analog to digital system which used phone lines so that people in remote rural areas with no internet access could dial a number, could leave a story, could listen back to their own story, and could hear the stories of others. In dialogue, they produced a system that could respond to the digital divide, building a community of women across remote areas where there is no online access. So it's not a story about, but a story co-designed with those involved in the issue. So my final example is Question Bridge, an American project which describes itself as a transmedia art project created by Chris Johnson, Hank Willis Thomas, Bayete Ross Smith, and Kamal Sinclair. Question Bridge seeks, and this is a quote, to represent and redefine black male identity in America through video-mediated question and answer exchange. Diverse members of this demographic bridge economic, political, geographic, and generational divisions. So the problem that the project addresses, how to address the economic precarity and marginalization of African-American men, a huge problem. A population who are, you know, economically disenfranchised, who are disproportionately represented in the prison population. And they wanted to address an idea which was expressed 100 years ago by W.E.B. Du Bois as double consciousness, the impact of racism on image and self-image within that group. And how they went about doing this was through this idea of the question. Participants are invited to offer a question that they would like to address to another black American man. Their questions about class, values, politics, individual and collective responsibility are filmed and played to other men who answer them. The dialogue between participants produced through editing then makes up the work. I saw this first in 2012 at an installation at Sheffield Dockfest, and it's very kind of moving to stand between these screens being addressed directly as if you're part of that group. But primarily it works among that group of men. So that invitation to ask a question works at a number of levels. It's simple call to action. Anyone can do it, you know. It's not intimidating. And it functions in a very generative way with lots of diverse men getting involved. At the same time, by asking for a question that bridges across economic, political, geographic difference, the question itself functions as a device to raise open the category black males, a category which is structured in a way by a history of racial oppression. You know, there are lots of differences within that group, not a simple demographic by any means. And the question goes right in there, opening up. So the work, launched in 2012 as a gallery installation and now also an interactive website, is a platform for conversations that happen online, but also in museums, galleries, YMCAs, prisons. There's a 75-minute version of the videos available for community screenings. There's an education curriculum that's been developed for high schools. And they've developed this format called a blueprint round table, where these conversations happen between generations in community settings. And thousands of individuals have been touched by the project to date. So in conclusion, in co-creative documentary media, we're less looking at an argument, more as media as a convening between people. These interactive documentaries convene a face-to-face dialogue, often with the filmmakers present. So if the 20th century model of documentary was about informing citizens, these co-creative projects are more like a stage on which people take part as citizens, bringing crucial issues to the attention of a wider public. So I'm so sorry that I have not shown you some clips. And I would say, I meant to put up at the end of my talk a still from the MIT Open Doc Lab DocuBase, because all these projects that I've mentioned are there, and it's an easy resource, one place you can look at, find out about all these projects and many others. So in the workshop shortly, we're going to be thinking a bit more about the participant experience in these projects and in some others. So that's it from me. Oh, I'll leave that. Oh, I see. Right, questions.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, maybe in the workshop. It's a perfect example, opportunity. Yes, please, Robert.
Like some of the people who have been asked to take part might not be media savvy, and are they being asked to sign sort of like release agreements that they might not be able to understand what the exact rights they're giving away?
I think it's a case by case issue, really, and I think different people go about that process of developing an agreement and writing it up in very different ways. But I think that's a critical issue. I mean, and in a way, I would say the idea of informed consent is a problematic idea in these environments. Yeah. So there's the issue of, you know, it's a complex issue, and it needs a deep conversation with people taking part. Yeah. Yes, go on.
I wanted to know, with the production of documentary, where do you see it going in the future with, say, mobile technology? Where do you see it heading? Because if people can go off and just make the film themselves with their mobile, how is it going to be convening with the technology making it more and more individualistic?
Yeah, well, I think it's a struggle, actually. I think it's one of the themes now. If you think of social media, for example, it's very much a one-person account. But I guess what's interesting about these stories is that they provide the opportunity to put multiple stories together. And I think we all, you know, we all We all have identifications with communities of interest in our lives. So I think what these projects provide is a way of bringing those individual stories together. And I think there'll continue to be a hunger for that and a need to do that from a political perspective as well. So, yeah, so and I think there are ways to, as we've been talking about, I think, probably already. I haven't given examples of mobile here. But, you know, one can bring those stories together. The exciting thing is that just right on your mobile phone here, you can be bearing witness to your own experience or to something you're seeing. And so the possibility of aggregating those stories is very much there. So there's a tension between that individualism and the group, and I think these projects offer the opportunity to come together as a group, that kind of idea of convening, which actually is Patty Zimmerman's idea, but I think it's just a very nice way of putting what goes on in these projects. Yes?
So I had a question about the people that fund the documentaries, how they measure the success of them. Because, let's say, typically, with a typical movie, people might want to know how many people saw it and use that number of views as a metric of success. But you could imagine something like the community getting together to discuss how their high-rise could be better,
how their community is
perceived. Yeah. It brings a massive benefit to that community just being involved in that conversation. So whether anybody else connects with that, maybe that doesn't matter.
No, and it's interesting. So measures, kind of metrics that just about how many people visit a website aren't going to take you very far with some of these projects. And I think it's a challenge for some of these projects. And I think it's one reason why people go about trying to fund some of these projects in a slightly different way. So Question Bridge has had money from foundations, from Tribeca Film Institute. Last year they raised $75,000 for the interactive website. So there is there is a big community of interest wanting to see that project being effective and wanting to see it build. Although I think it's interesting about this project, which I really respect, that I don't think the interactive website works that well, because I think people are interested in what happens in this face-to-face setting. They're interested in the blueprint workshops. They're interested in being together. And that idea that people can just upload a video from their mobile to the Question Bridge site, it doesn't seem to be getting a strong response. So, multiple forms of funding. But it's a problem I'm sure people here are aware of this. There's a real problem about how do you measure engagement and impact when it's much more complex than have I watched something? Did I understand it? And I think it's a struggle for some of these projects. And they have to look in multiple dimensions around funding to demonstrate to people, to get sources of funding and to demonstrate what they're about.
It might be a kind of like art therapy. And the movie or the project is kind of like a MacGuffin in a way, because otherwise they might not come together to talk about it.
No, I ran a digital storytelling project for 8 years at the BBC, at BBC Wales, and it was always a real struggle because we had, we had very big impact in the communities that we visited, and some impact with the small number of stories that were on BBC One. But there was a discrepancy in the BBC's metrics between that local intense connection and the kind of idea, the kind of Barb idea of the household survey. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But documentary's never been easy to fund. So, there wasn't a model before that was easy. It's always been a problem. Yeah.
When you talk about evaluation, it's kind of like there's some projects which I've worked on where you have do a questionnaire, you say your attitudes towards this, and this, and evaluation of the end, and how that changes. I was thinking I was thinking especially about the tool like Deductive, it's kind of like the interactivity is kind of like if a project could incorporate evaluation in the actual interaction itself. And so at the end of it, you could actually prove that people's attitudes changed or whatever by the time they completed the engagement with the project.
But I guess to some extent we're still looking at a kind of mass media model of evaluation in which an intense engagement for a small number of people barely kind of shows. Yes, yeah, so, yeah.
But that would work, because that's exactly what that evaluation process is designed for. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you can only reach 20 people mm-hmm. in a housing estate, but if those 20 people have taken a journey mm-hmm. and moved somewhere else by an international project, mm-hmm. that is value. And funders, people that fund mm-hmm. those projects, they have to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, like, but actually incorporate the tools we're using for interaction to do that evaluation rather than having a checkbox with a load of surveys on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Do you know story pilot models for this?
Yeah.
Story pilot is the same kind of story. Evaluations that shift more towards social value. Evaluation is doing exactly what you described, that's sustainable and going through. But the economics foundation has some really nice cross-models that translate quite neatly to this area of work.
Who, I didn't hear which.
Okay.
The
methodologies are really well worked out, and they are, but they're based exactly on that deep engagement.
So Yes,
I was wondering, could you tell us a little bit about the balance between inviting, you know, everybody to participate, but then also editing the content to create a meaningful, entertaining experience for everybody. Also, in terms of I know that's a problematic term, but truth, you know, like whether it's true what people are saying about certain things, or are there means of editing?
There's not a one answer to that problem. I mean, interesting question, Bridge, again. They decided that they were going to use all the material. You know, they said, actually, if we start... They you know, done interviews with or got interviews with X thousand men, and they decided, actually, if we start deciding which ones are the right answers, that's wrong. So they went with using everything. And in a way, that's one response which works in some projects. In other projects, it could just feel like there's no sense in it. But in this project, and I guess that's what I was talking about the framing device of the question being just so apt to the problem they're trying to open up. So I guess in each case, you have to think about what the purpose is, what you're trying to do, and what the media material is that can best support that project. But I think then you're into, you know, truth. We're into the problems that have always been the problems of documentary. You know, point of view, selection, you know, issues that, you know, bear on truth, you know. And in a way, those are the issues by which we judge a documentary. When we watch a piece of media, how do we, you know, does it feel, does the grain of it feel like we're watching some kind of, I mean, what, you know, Jean Rouche, one of my heroes, said, you know, cinema verite is not the film of truth, but the truth of film. And in a way, every documentary is a massive selection. Every documentary involves somebody turning a camera on this, rather than this, or this, or this. And in a way, how you judge it is by feeling, is there a truth in there that feels like it has the grain of our social world in it, you know? So, yeah, so at one level, these documentaries are just like any other, but they involve some of the people who are in front of the camera in that conversation in a much deeper way.
And have there been some, like, tools, like, create these experiences or channel these software tools?
I'm not sure I can think of anything that's a kind of standardization. This one, again, is they're planning to make this a platform that other people can use. I mean, the fact is you could make a question bridge tomorrow yourself, but they're planning to actually develop the platform as something that people can use within other community contexts. So other than that, I'm trying to think, Sandra. Can you think of anything? So for interactive documentary, yes, Sandra's mentioning various open platforms that help you sort and organise clips and audio and text. But for this collaborative thing, not that I can think of. People. The tools are communication between people.